Well, now I want to begin taking you a step further. So that's Moses. I hope it's clear enough, simple enough. But I'm trying to see the richest strains of the New Testament when they talk about prophecy. Jesus the prophet. Is Jesus the prophet greater even than Moses? In his intimacy with God and in the way he bore with the pains of life and sustained his journey in fidelity. And it's that last point that I'll spend the rest of the night with you on. To do so, we need to go back a little bit in history, and after Moses, but before Jesus. And I want to take you to the Babylonian exile. Remind you of some things you know, and perhaps put a few things in perspective. The exile in Babylon started with the destruction of the city of Jerusalem in 587. There was a certain numbers of people, including the king, was exiled, 10 years before that. But basically it was a space in between that, and then there was the revolution and so on. But the final destruction of the city, the date usually given is 587 BC. And for some 50 years, the people who were exiled, and there were many thousands of them, in Babylon, had to make their best there, set up a home there and start business, and many of them did. They weren't all treated terribly badly, but at any rate, they were in a foreign land. The decree permitting their return, the date is a little bit, there's some uncertainties about this, but 538 is generally given as a date. And from that period on, they started to begin their journey back to Jerusalem. When they were in Babylon, there were certain developments of Jewish spirituality which are very, very important and central to tonight's lecture. One of them seems to have been a new humility that they acquired, and you can find in the writings that belong to this period. Because I think we've got to really fear what it would be like for a Judahite, that is a Jew, when the city was destroyed. They believed it was God's city. They believed it was God's temple. And right back in 721, which is whatever, 150 years earlier, when Samaria fell, when the Assyrians came in and took the whole of the northern kingdom, miraculously Jerusalem was spared. And even though it was a traumatic and terrible thing for the nation to lose all the northern part, still all the promises attached to David were intact. The kingdom of David was still there, reigning on the throne. And the people in the south, that is the Judahites, from which our word Jew comes, they could see the fall of the north as because of they weren't faithful to Yahweh. But try to imagine what it would be like when a foreign nation actually destroyed the city of Jerusalem, God's city. They thought it was impossible. They thought it couldn't possibly happen. They thought that God's temple couldn't be destroyed by pagan gods. They just presumed that God would be on their side. The temple of God, the temple of God, the temple of God. And it didn't happen like that. And in spite of the message of the prophets Jeremiah and so on, whatever of the insight of the people who could see, the ordinary people, I think this would be a fair statement, just took it for granted, like people once might have taken it for granted, that Rome will always be there, so the Pope will always be in Rome or something. Our equivalent, I think, would be if the Vatican was just totally destroyed or went bankrupt or something, which doesn't seem all that impossible, and it suddenly wasn't there anymore. And that would be a disjointing thing for many people. Even more so, the city being destroyed and the whole nation wiped out, it appeared, must have been a terrible experience for these people. And what it seems to have brought into their spirituality was a new humility. A reliance now, they had to rely now on God, not on the temple, not on the Davidic king, not on the institutions, not on all the things that they thought gave them their security. Now there's none of that, none of it's left. So either, and I presume the majority, just gave up faith altogether. But those who believed had to refine their faith back to faith in God. That was the first thing I want to stress with you. The second is really important too. They came in contact for the first time with a bigger culture. They had their own little few square miles around the Jerusalem hills, but now they're in Babylon. There's more trade there. The language is a simpler language. There's more government. There's just a whole new kind of way of life opening up to them. New mythology, new stories. And that's where they got all their stories about creation, for example, from the Babylonians at this time. It's a time of real renewal of their new mind-blowing stuff for them. And a couple of things that it brought to the explicit consciousness of the people. One was monotheism. I may have mentioned this before, but if I could just hold it again now briefly. They realized more than ever before, and perhaps for the first time, that there is only one God, Yahweh. They realized that God isn't just, I am the Lord your God, you shall not put strange gods before me. You know, the first commandment. That other gods were less than God and under God, and he was the all-powerful, almighty God. Now they realize that the other gods just didn't even exist. That the gods of the Babylonians that they thought were kind of famous, when they went over there, they showed them their gods. And their gods were kind of gold bulls or something up in a man-made tower, because it's a flat country. They didn't have their own mountains for their gods. So, and being people who worship gods of mountains, they had to build their mountains. So they, like we have skyscrapers, but they weren't quite as high. They built what they were called ziggurat, was the name. And that's the story of the Tower of Babel, the Tower of Babylon. They built their own towers to hold their own gods. And the Jews looked at these gods and they couldn't believe it. They said they were made of wood and they were made of stone, and they said they've got eyes and can't see and ears and can't hear, and they'd go home laughing about this whole ridiculous gods that they were worshipping. If they came to Sydney and saw the ones we worship, they'd probably just die of despair, because we're far more foolish, I presume, than the Babylonians ever thought of doing it. But that made them realize that the God that they, whom they couldn't make any images of, they couldn't have an image of their God, because how can you make an image of the God of the universe? And not only images like in stone, they didn't have verbal images either in a way. They weren't allowed to theologize strictly. They couldn't define God in words either. They didn't even use his name. Whenever they read Yahweh, they said another word, because they didn't want to pretend that they could put a name on the mystery. And that's a lovely attitude to have. Well, anyhow, monotheism grew in this period very strongly, a great wonder of the one Redeemer, the one Yahweh, the one God. Thirdly, a missionary awareness, a sense that they as a people, they sensed themselves as the chosen people, that they had a mission for the world, that these poor benighted people, the people who lived in darkness, who were worshipping foolishly these man-made gods to no avail, they needed to know about Yahweh. And so those spiritual ones among them, anyhow, had a sense of mission to the world, which was new and very lovely. And now I come to the point I'm going to develop further. During this period of the Babylonian exile, there's a number of books belong to it. There's the prophecy of Ezekiel, which I'll take as known, and I don't want to go into it. The main one that I'm interested in is the second book of Isaiah. Chapters 40 to 55 of Isaiah belong to this period, and they dream about going back. They believed, because of the faith in Yahweh, that one day, just as God through Moses had gone into Egypt and brought them out of Egypt, so God would come and bring them out of Babylon back home. You follow that easily, don't you? And they dreamed about the kind of leader that they would need. He'd obviously be a leader like Moses, a prophet like Moses. And Moses is the image they've got in mind when they talk about this leader. But you're going to see with me as we begin our journey now that this prophet, the spirituality of the second book of Isaiah, is the spirituality of the prophet servant, the servant of Yahweh, but it's the suffering servant of Yahweh. It's a servant who understands monotheism, total fidelity to the one God, but a servant who has a missionary zeal that'll go to the whole world, and also a profound humility and faith in God, even in adversity. Because they, I suppose, one thing, they'd been murdered and everything back in Jerusalem, and they were carted off as a subject people. That's a humiliation enough for a people. But when they got, I think it's reading between the lines, but probably fair reconstruction, when they got into Babylon, and when many of their co-religionists lost faith, as one would expect to happen, and settled down in Babylonia and said, blow all our dreams, let's make the best of this, and started up the banks of Rothschild and all the rest of it. My history isn't too good there, a few generations out, but that style of thing. And they no doubt did pretty well at exchange, because that's part of their talent. So they seemed to, and many of them, most of them stayed on. The faithful ones who talked about the dream and talked about the Holy Land and talked about going home were no doubt scoffed at, laughed at, told they were stupid, and why don't you settle down and fancy believing all that. They must have gone through a lot of pain. It's expressed, captured, perhaps better, really beautifully in Psalm that you all know well, but I'll read the first bit to you, Psalm 137, which reads, besides the streams of Babylon, we sat and wept at the memory of Zion, leaving our harps hanging on the poplars there. For we'd been asked to sing to our captors, to entertain those who'd carried us off. Sing, they said, some hymns of Zion. How could we sing one of Yahweh's hymns in a pagan country? Jerusalem, if I forget you, may my right hand wither. May I never speak again if I forget you, if I do not count Jerusalem the greatest of my joys. And so they longed, the faithful ones, the remnant, those perhaps few who kept believing now in God, they longed for some prophet, Moses-like leader, to come and take them and out to the world with a mission, but take them home to their country, their Jerusalem, their city of God. And then when the announcement was made, Cyrus of Persia overran the Babylonian Empire. It was in a state of decline when it captured Jerusalem. There were a few wars and battles at court and all the rest you can leave, but 50 years after the destruction of Jerusalem, Babylon itself was destroyed, and the new emperor, the Persian emperor, had a whole new policy whereby he allowed peoples to go back to their own countries. He demanded taxation from them, and they were still a subject people, but they were allowed to have their own worship, their own country, and so on. And that policy worked marvellously for Persia. It was a much more sensible organisational plan, and went right through till the Greeks in turn overran the Persians, which you know a bit of history there, Alexander the Great and so on. So that historical data was an answer to prayer and a miracle of grace as they saw it, and then they began their journey, and the story of it is in that second Isaiah 40-55. In that Isaiah 40-55, within that 15 chapters or 16 chapters of material, there are four songs of the servant, and I think they're very beautiful, and I want to meditate with you on them tonight. They are songs of the servant, poetic ways of speaking of the prophet, the leader, and it captures their spirituality very beautifully. Why I want to present them is for their own inherent beauty, but much more so because when the New Testament came to talk of Jesus and looked back in their poetry and their epics and their whole religious language for images and words to speak about the Jesus they knew, they keep going back all the time, 50 times and more. So it's not just, as I'll show you, they keep going back to the songs of the servant of Yahweh. Here we are at the real key to Jesus' personality. The numerous occasions in which they remind themselves of these songs. Not that the songs express Jesus perfectly, how could they? How can you ever express anyone perfectly? But they had no better way of speaking about him. And so we've really got to be on the most sure ground in speaking about the kind of prophet Jesus was, the way in which he was greater even than Moses, and the character and quality of his personality. The New Testament tells us, go and read these songs. So I'll do it with you now, and be sure that we're really close to the most sacred words we can find to put on who is Jesus at a very simple human level. Let me start with you then. It's chapter 42 of Isaiah, and it's verses 1 to 7. And it reads, as you can see, like this. Here is my servant, whom I uphold, my chosen one, in whom my soul delights. I have endowed him with my spirit, that he may bring true justice to the nations. To the nations, to the world. He does not cry out or shout aloud, or make his voice heard in the streets. He does not break the crushed reed, nor quench the wavering flame. Faithfully, he brings true justice. He will neither waver nor be crushed until true justice is established on earth, for the islands are awaiting his law. I, Yahweh, have called you to serve the cause of right. I have taken you by the hand and formed you. I have appointed you as a covenant to the people and light to the nations, to open the eyes of the blind, to free captives from prison and those who live in darkness from the dungeon. Let's go through that a bit more slowly. The first thing that you can do very simply is look at it and think of Moses, and you're right. He's the image that they're writing from in a way. And it all applies to Moses very beautifully, except that within it you can already see some of the new developments of awareness and spirituality that are emerging in these exile people. The stress particularly on the justice to the nations, on the law that Moses gave, but now the islands are awaiting the law, the very edges of the world, out to sea, as it were, on the way to nothingness. And again, the stress on those in the dungeon of slavery, but now it's the darkness of Babylon. It's the mental darkness of a world that is incapable of seeing the beauty of the God, of the Yahweh. So there's some lovely developments of spirituality there. That's the first thing that you can do, is it? The second thing is to think of Jesus. And let me take you through some texts you're probably familiar with. It's actually quoted. If you look up sometime Matthew chapter 12, verse 18 to 21, he quotes that song of Jesus. So what I'm doing is simply what the Gospels do. But the context is very interesting. Matthew 12, 18 to 21. Matthew 11, the last few verses of Matthew 11, just prior to this, are those verses where Jesus says, come to me, all you who labor and are overburdened, crushed and wavering almost, and I will give you rest. Learn from me, for I am meek and gentle in heart, and you'll find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy. We did it last week, didn't we? And my burden is light. And that text has come at the end of a debate between Jesus and the Pharisees, the law makers and Jesus, the new prophet, bringing the new law. And there's a battle trying to work out which law is right. And after that statement of Jesus about taking his yoke, the yoke of his law, upon them, the law that the islands are awaiting, there's obviously a profound difference between the two. Straight after that, in the beginning of chapter 12, just before this is quoted, you have that scene picking the corn on the Sabbath. And the Pharisees accuse his apostles. And Jesus says, if only you knew the meaning of the words, what I want is love, not sacrifice, you would not judge the innocent. You would not condemn the innocent. You'd not bring your law of Sabbath organization to bear down and oppress innocent people, because they're breaking your customs and your newfangled kind of ideas of keeping God's law intact. There's obviously a conflict again. The very next scene, just prior to this, is that beautiful scene in the synagogue with a man with a withered hand, and Jesus calls him out into the front and says to the Pharisees, and the conflict is head on, is it lawful on the Sabbath to give life or to kill? To give life or take it, to kill or to... I've forgotten the exact words now. But confronting them with that, and then he cures the man and they go out to destroy him. And immediately Matthew quotes that. Jesus is the new lawgiver, and the islands are awaiting his law. He is bringing true justice to the whole world, according to Matthew's community. And he is the servant, the one in whom God delights. And what kind of person is he? What kind of prophet is he? Like the prophet, the servant of Yahweh here, he's not one who cries out or shouts aloud or makes his voice heard in the streets. He doesn't break the crushed reed or quench the wavering flame. There's a gentleness, a compassion. He is the prophet who's come to love people into goodness rather than condemn us in our evil. Secondly, just staying with that first song, just look at the first two lines of it. Here is my servant whom I uphold, my chosen one in whom my soul delights. Now, that's the English translation of the Septuagint Bible, which you can find up in our library if you wish. The Greek of the Septuagint is translated there, literally, into English. But there were many versions going around at the time of Jesus, and the version that was obviously available to Matthew, for example, because he quotes it in Matthew 12, it's slightly different, and it reads like this, and I've just put it... I needn't have done all this, but I have, and may or may not interest you, but interested me, so... That's the actual text that he uses. And the servant of me, my servant. And pais in Greek means servant. It could mean boy. It's like the French garçon. It could mean your boy, meaning your son, or it could mean boy who's doing the service. Exactly the same feeling. So it's a general word. Could be boy, could be son, servant. But okay. So my servant... My agapetos, my loved one, my beloved. The one in whom my psyche, my soul, my psyche, my heart, mind, and a lovely word here, delights. My servant, my loved one, the one in whom my soul delights, who seems wonderful to me. Now that's the text of Isaiah 42:1, the first verse of the first song of the servant of Yahweh, as in the text quoted by Matthew. In the baptism, exactly the same text, slight alterations. Pais has become huios, it's become son, strictly. because of them, you are my son. Now there's no doubt here. There's a transforming of language indicating a special intimacy, which we've looked at already. My son, my beloved, and this is simply put in the first person, I delight in you. You can see it's the same text. Eh? Which is doing what? Very important. That's the first statement God makes to Jesus in the whole gospel. That's chapter 1, verse 11 of Mark. That's the baptism scene. That's the very beginnings of Jesus' mission. It's the grace that makes him the prophet we see him to be in the public ministry. And here you've got, and Matthew and Luke do the same, and John in his own way also quotes this, the chosen one of God in a different setting, in the baptism setting, but in a different way. So all the Gospels at the beginning present Jesus to us the way we've already seen him, as loved by God, that was our first lecture, as the Son of God, which was our second lecture earlier on. But in what way was he loved by God? In what way is he the Son of God? What does it mean to be the Son of God in the human condition? They said, go and look at the songs of the servant of Yahweh. He's the Son, the way the servant is, far more beautifully, of course, but he's the servant in whom the soul delights. And so you get back to your text again. That's what we're supposed to do when we read the baptism text. We're supposed to go back and read the whole of that song and learn something of the fidelity, the justice, the determination, but the gentleness of Jesus. And he is the new covenant, and his task, his missionary task, the purpose of the baptism was that he would be the light to the nations, he would open the eyes of the blind, he would free anyone who's in prison anywhere, any kind of prison, mind, body, heart, and anyone living in darkness, of meaninglessness, he would bring them out of that dungeon into the light. A couple more that you can probably see still looking at that first song. This is surely behind the statement of Simeon. Right back in Luke chapter 2, 31, when the old man, this is Luke's poetry preparing us for this, when the old man took the little baby in his arms and said, now you may let your servant go in peace according to your word, for my eyes have seen your salvation. And please remember, Jesus means Yahweh, salvation. His very name says that. I've seen the meaning one, the one who's going to save the glory of your people Israel. The beautiful flowering of Israel, and he goes on, a light to enlighten the nations and the glory of your people Israel. So he is the glory, but he's also a light of the nations. And you remember John's Gospel, Jesus says, I am the light of the world. Same theme, playing on the minds of these people as they speak of him. And at the Last Supper, in keeping with the mood of that song, Jesus took bread, broke it, and said, take it, eat, all of you, eat it. This is my body broken for you. Broken for those who are in slavery. Take the bread, the unleavened bread, the bread for a journey, the bread for a hasty Exodus journey, a Passover journey. And then he took the cup with wine and says, this is my blood of the covenant. This is the love covenant between God and anyone. Many, 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 whoever wants. Not just a few, not a remnant, not a leftover few, not a faithful little group that have, but it's for many, in Aramaic meaning everyone if you want to, whoever wants to, a covenant of love in the broken body and the poured out blood of the one who neither wavered nor was crushed until true justice was established on earth, who didn't break the crushed reed or quench the wavering flame, and who paid the price of the servant like Moses himself, bearing the weight of the people on him, but doing it faithfully. Jesus took the weight of the world upon him and kept freeing captives from prison right through to his own passion.